Podium mics, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Mic 1, test 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Mic 2, testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Mic 3.
I can hear it back, Doyle.
Mic 3. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Mic 4. Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Mic 4.
Okay, Vega mic number 1. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Vega mic number 2, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Vega mic number 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. End of test.
Okay. Sir?
That's what the sign says. If we might have your attention, and if we can't, one announcement on the simulation schedule. The news monitoring or photographable simulation preceding this flight is now scheduled for next Tuesday morning. At 8 a.m. And we generally plan to do about 3 reentry simulations in the course of the day, picking up the flight at the tag end. This afternoon, we've targeted about an hour for this first session, and the crew has some 15 minutes worth of training film and videotape I know they want to show you. We would ask one limitation on the session this afternoon. And that is, please, let's try to restrict our thinking and thus our questioning to the subject of Apollo 7, which is a very big subject, at least 2 years in the making, perhaps more. But I think we must impose this limitation. These people have been very much tied up in their project. And while they do have a lot of ideas about hunting, other projects, and other topics, I think we're going to have to, with the time limitation as well as anything else, have to restrict it to the upcoming flight. Now, I think I saw the crew come in earlier. Yeah, here there are 3 reporters I don't recognize over here. You want to start off with the film, Wally, or what?
Yeah.
Okay. I think they'd probably want
to. Second camera,
you've got mics and everything.
Okay.
I mean, you don't know Captain Skyra and Izell, Major Izell by now?
Thank you, Mr. Heaney.
Heaney.
Honey? It's all yours.
I guess the way to start out to keep you prepared is to show you something. So we'd like to start off with a clip, about a 10 or 12 minute clip of the films that have been accumulated over the past 6 months, I'd say, of our various training activities, and I'd like to narrate those as we go along. There's no soundtrack on it, but some of the stuff you might recognize.
Oh boy, yeah.
We call these suits our big lumpy suits. And the reason for this is that they, on the left couch, my couch, and on Walt's couch, the two outer couches, the crewmen will ultimately be those who will go to the moon in the LEM. To protect them from heat, thermal loads on the surface of the moon, and from micrometeoroid protection, there are various layers of protective garment, and they become quite thick and bulky. We, in fact, of course, are not worried about that on this mission, but we're using it as a trial case. Here is the water egress training with the press boat in attendance. And you see that we've inflated three large bags to bring the spacecraft to an upright, stable position. It is stable down as well as up, so the bags are added to the system to help upright it. And Don Isley at this time is deploying the life raft into which the three of us will enter shortly. This exercise was conducted off Galveston in the Gulf of Mexico. The suit itself is a watertight compartment. We have neck rings on, which may not be too visible to you, gloves on, and then, of course, the life vest, which are a ram horn shape that go underneath the armpits to make the total system redundant again. The spacecraft, as all previous ones, is a lousy boat. Here is our slide wire egress training. This is a mode of leaving the umbilical tower if there's a problem developing on the launch pad. We prefer this, in fact, to the elevator. One of the reasons we prefer it is it's a very rapid mode of egress. At this point where you see Don Isley about to unhook, he is 1,200 feet away from the booster. These suits that we have on here are our backup suits. They are capable of being used in flight itself. The suits we used on the water egress training were training suits in that they would suffer from the salt water. And here is our ballet dancer, Walt Cunningham. This contrivance is a simulation of the swing arm and white room that attaches to the spacecraft on the launch pad. This is actually in our training building, and we practice egress. As you noticed, the first clip was water egress, the slide wire egress. Here we are practicing spacecraft egress to the swing arm that's up at the 220-foot level where the spacecraft hatch is. To the left of the lower left corner of the picture, you'll see three compartments. There are three containers. These are portable oxygen supply, which are used for breathing all the way down from the spacecraft to the ground level. We preserve the integrity of the suit so that we can breathe the oxygen within it. I think you'll notice that that is a quick opening hatch. Notice in this particular case how much faster we're coming out than we might in subsequent pictures. The reason for this is that we have training suits on, and we're not worried about tearing the suits or breaking up the spacecraft. This is a mock-up of the spacecraft. We'll go through the same drill in some other clips that you'll see, but we will not try to play games with it as we just did there. This is another mock-up we were working with to check our hose routing and configuration of all of the stowage equipment in the spacecraft. This particular mock-up had every item that the actual spacecraft would have stored within it. We haven't figured out what Don Isley was doing there. If you all know, let us be aware of it. This is a typical stowage device. It's a large formed block of a silicone-type material that will not burn. Within it are various components of camera equipment. You may recognize some lenses and film magazines. Don is in the lower equipment bay, actually going through every item that would be stowed in that block. It's a refresher. We've done this many, many times. This is only to do it with the total environment of the suit, the hoses, and the equipment. This is a picture of 101 itself in the altitude chamber. And on this particular test, of course, we're wearing the flight suits that we will wear for the mission, and we are running the spacecraft on its first truly hazardous test, in contrast to what we considered not totally hazardous in the past, meaning in this case that the environment is oxygen, it's a 60-40 mixture, and we will, of course, in the suits itself have 100% oxygen. We will go to altitude on that particular run. These particular photographs were taken with the onboard 16-millimeter movie camera with a wide-angle lens, and that's why you'll notice this distortion. For those in the know, it's an 18-millimeter wide-angle lens. We have a number of film backs on board, which I think will be the most profitable picture-taking we'll take, in that we're going into a new realm with the Apollo Command Module, one that we've labeled IVA, intra-vehicular activity. And the motions that we discern there that may or may not be problems, we can document with this onboard movie camera. It just shows we know how to make home movies, too. On this exercise, we are playing with a real spacecraft, with our real suits, so we're coming out very slowly, very carefully, so that we do not tear them. If it were a real emergency, we would come diving out instead of just crawling out very carefully. I'm not sure whether you're aware or not, but these suits represent almost $100,000 a copy, with one pair of pants. John Young is standing in the foreground there, the command module pilot of our backup crew. John will be very much involved in our launch day preparations. He will actually come in the spacecraft with us when we get in and help us run some of the switches that are not accessible to us when we're in the couches. And then we'll get out just before we leave. At least that's his intent from what I've heard. Now here we are in the suit lab, where we are being suited for possibly one of the tests you just saw. And we're now exiting the building where the suit lab is, entering the transfer van, which will take us to the launch pad. I think it's rather interesting to note over the years the much better transportation we have. I can recall on Mercury had a big old semi-truck pulling a trailer behind it on the way down to the Mercury pad. And the pad seemed to get just a little bit larger since those days. On this particular sequence, the total service structure is there. This is normally moved away, and just the umbilical tower is available for the crew ingress. That particular sequence was entering the base of the elevator area. We're now up in what is called the white room, which is the clean room that protects the spacecraft from dust and debris and changes in environment. These are the rescue vehicles, the M113 tanks. They're coated with a rather thick layer of fireproofing. Notice the hatch did not open as fast as we anticipated it should. There was a procedural error here that was done pre-ingress before we got there, which has since been remedied to get a full pneumatic charge on the opening cylinder, which opens the hatch.
Well, we didn't think this was a satisfactory demonstration of that hatch, so we asked to have it rerun. That was done a day later, and with a proper procedure, and the hatch worked as advertised. It popped open all by itself. But on this particular one, it slowed us down a bit.
This is probably a good example of why we need to do these things over and over again. You've seen rehearsals. This is for real. There is a carpet there, again, to protect our suits. And we, again, do not wish to hurt the spacecraft. Here is this portable oxygen supply. Flip it over your head and then connect it up to the suit. The suit at this point, until that's hooked up, is a closed bag, if I may. That you can breathe in, but eventually you run out of oxygen and you can become asphyxiated rather rapidly from a CO2 buildup. This particular supply will last about 7 or 8 minutes and give enough flow for cooling as well as for breathing. Now we're going across the swing arm to the elevator for an elevator egress. We could just as well have gone down the slide wire depending on the pad situation. Here we are egressing as if there were fire. There is a spray that we can go through as a freshwater spray. And we're playing for real here. I think it's rather interesting to note at the end of this, we're not sure which bus we're supposed to take. There is a little confusion. We now know which bus to take. I think Walt forgot his token. These particular vehicles are manned by some rather courageous men, I think. This is what you will see at best from the spacecraft in flight. This is an onboard TV camera used in an aircraft flying over Corpus Christi. And I think you can recognize that there is a man in the seat of that cockpit. And there is one on his left as well. Now, this particular sequence was shot in the airplane cockpit, transmitted to the ground at Corpus Christi and run through the landlines and converted back to the type of picture that you will have available from on board. You may notice a blurring motion in that our scan rate is tremendously slower than the typical scan rate of the commercial product. They aren't as busy as we'll be. I think he's checking his fingernails, but I'm not sure. And this is a air-to-ground view of the Corpus Christi area. My first observation of this, which was just earlier today, I thought that large dark area on the right side of the screen was Aransas Pass, but it's moving. It is part of the airplane. It's the engine. I have seen a few engines on airplanes, and I have seen Aransas Pass, so you can judge the quality of what you're looking for from this sequence. I only mean to make note of this for you so that you're not looking forward to the typical TV picture that is available continually to the public. This is about as good as we can afford to carry on this flight at this time. I don't believe we have any earth-shaking or earth-leaving remarks to leave with you. The flight plan has been pretty well explained to everyone. Our major goal is to do something different in the space program. Our first Mercury flight was 15 minutes. Our first Gemini flight was 4.5 hours. We're hoping to do 10.8 days on the first Apollo flight. I feel it's a very ambitious undertaking. If we succeed in getting most of that time done with the spacecraft systems, we feel that we've accomplished a lot with this first flight, enough so that possibly we can be more adventurous on subsequent flights. If we aren't that successful, subsequent flights may have different demands placed on them. After our first day in orbit, we will have a maneuver to return to the S-4B, and our navigator, who has a right to know where we are, should discuss that maneuver. Don Isley.
About 24 hours after liftoff, we'll commence a sequence of exercises aimed at doing a rendezvous with the S-4B booster that we're separated from about 3 hours after liftoff. At 3 hours after liftoff, we will separate from the booster with about a 7 foot per second delta V maneuver. This will cause us over a period of the next 20 hours or so to move out in front of the booster by some 60 to 100 nautical miles. We don't know exactly how far it'll be because it depends on the relative drag between the booster and the spacecraft. At about 24 hours, we will execute a burn called NCC-1, which stated simply means it's a maneuver to put you in a relative position behind the target where you can then execute another burn called NSR, which is designed to circularize or get co-elliptic with the booster at a slightly lower altitude, and therefore with a catch-up rate, you proceed to move toward the booster. And at a relative position to the target of about 8 miles below it and some 18 to 20 miles behind it, we will execute a transfer maneuver. This will be a very small burn in terms of feet per second. We'll do it with our small reaction control thrusters. And this phase of the mission will then carry us up to the target. And hopefully, when we get close enough, we'll be able to do a braking maneuver and end up side by side with it, or nose to nose. Some of the interesting features of this exercise are the fact that we have to do all this without benefit of any sort of onboard radar. The whole exercise is based on optical tracking through the sextant and telescope. It's part of the guidance system. And this system, although theoretically capable of doing this job, depends very heavily on having a pretty good idea of what your relative position is when you start the maneuver following the co-elliptic burn. We hope to prove that it is feasible to intercept and rendezvous with a vehicle without having radar on board, because that's exactly what people are going to have to do on subsequent missions. In case what I'm referring to is a LEM command module mission, where you have people out in the LEM, and in case the LEM cannot execute the rendezvous, the command module has to. So we've got to demonstrate a LEM rescue capability, which is the whole reason for this exercise. And we've been spending a great deal of our training time on it because it is quite intricate. Computer programs are quite involved. We also have a number of backup measures, backup charts and procedures, which we can use that not only serve to correlate and cross-check the computer solution, but also can be used, in fact, to accomplish the rendezvous in case of a guidance system malfunction. And also a third piece of data, or third way of doing it, is by ground solution. We hope to have very good ground tracking through the MSFN network. And they can also generate solutions for times to burn and magnitudes of delta Vs to affect the rendezvous. So we hope to put all three of these sources together and come up with the right answer in terms of delta V direction and magnitude to get up to the booster.
The other major area of concern on the flight is to validate all of the onboard systems to prove that the basic design of the electrical power system, of the reaction control system, of the environmental control system is in fact sufficient for the total lunar mission. And I think we've developed out of this particular crew the best prepared systems man in the whole astronaut office. I think Walt Cunningham should give you an explanation of what he is going to worry about on the balance of the 10.8-day mission.
Well, as Wally mentioned, one of the prime requisites of this flight is to come back with a feeling that all of the spacecraft systems are capable of supporting a flight of duration that would take you to the moon and back. And in this vein, a good portion of the effort on the flight is devoted to what we call detailed test objectives. A good share of these are aimed at obtaining the data where you can qualify the communication system, all of the telemetry system, SPS system, the service propulsion, the reaction control system, and any other system that does fit on the spacecraft. Towards this end, one of the most significant items that we're going to be doing is validating the service module propulsion system. With that in mind, we'll be making nominally 8 burns of the service propulsion system. The first 2 burns, Don has already mentioned, as a part of the rendezvous. Subsequent to that time, we'll be verifying the capability of the propulsion system to put out what we call a minimum impulse burn. This is an effort to get the very smallest amount of thrust out of the service propulsion system, which would then enable you to save your reaction control system propellant. That will be done twice in an effort to verify that capability. There will be a very long duration burn in which we are attempting to qualify the onboard gauging system of the service module. There will be burns which will be done to verify the backup attitude control system, the stabilization control system, that is. Of course, there will be a deorbit burn, and that burn will be done at the end of 164 revs nominally. If in the interim the flight plan has to be changed, there will still be an attempt made to accommodate all of these burns as possible. We also have a lot to verify on the reaction control system. We should all keep in mind that that is the backup deorbit capability on this particular spacecraft. I'm sure you're all aware that we've left the world of retro rockets, and we now have to depend on what we call dynamic systems, in that they don't sit there and wait for 10 days to be used. The reaction control system is just such a system, and it in fact can do the job if the service propulsion system can't. The communication system on this vehicle is extremely complicated. It's tied up with what we call VHF, as we've used in the past. In addition, it has a system operating in the S-band, which is the only way we'll be able to communicate at lunar distances. And a good share of the qualification of that will have to be done in Earth orbit. The electric power system, we're flying fuel cells. You're probably familiar with the fuel cells we had in Gemini, and they went through growing pains. I tend to think that the growing pains could be somewhat less on this particular fuel cell. It's been around a long time. It's not the same as the one on Gemini. However, that's one area where we'll be keeping our fingers crossed early in the flight. The environmental control system, which I haven't mentioned up to now, is obviously near and dear to all our hearts. And as usual, it's as complicated as you can possibly imagine. However, its importance is matched by that complication, and we feel like all aspects of the environmental control system is going to be a big part of the effort in qualifying this vehicle. We only hope that we don't end up with it also taking up a major portion of our time. I feel like it's only yesterday that I talked to most of you from Dover about the suit, so I think I'd probably leave it here and just leave it for questions. I'd like to take this opportunity to introduce my wife, who's present for her first press conference. Care to stand up, Lo? Go ahead, Walt.
I guess what we should leave you with is the realization that we are just about ready to fly this mission. We have one major test to go. That's the flight readiness test, which should occur sometime this next week. There are some minor problems which we do not accept as being flight ready yet. We will have answers on those. There's a meeting, in fact, at this time going on at the Cape called a Flight Readiness Review, which is a meeting between MSC here, Houston Management, and KSC Cape Management, and the representative engineers and technicians for those particular areas of concern. That will be again reviewed with the NASA headquarters management and technical personnel about the 1st or 2nd of October. That's when we'll say we're ready for go. The flight readiness test itself is the last formal test, and I think if that test gives us any problems, we will then, of course, say as a crew we are not ready to go. At this point, I can say we are not ready to go until that test is complete. We see no reason for us to delay beyond the announced date of 11 October at this time, though. So in that sense, we're hoping the test goes and that we go with it. Is Paul still here? Did you want to monitor some questions?
Space reporters are such a well-policed group, they don't really need a moderator. We would ask, in the interest of time, we'll do away with the identification thing, but I think you should wait for Larry Worrell and the stick here. If there are no questions, we've gained a half an hour already.
Looks like they're going to get us when they got us in private. Well.
Sanders.
Question regards the open ends that you mentioned. As far as the crew is concerned, what are some of the open ends that you want to see corrected before you're ready to go?
You saw one example of it, the way the hatch did not work properly. This we've solved. There are other areas. We've had some modifications in the hand controllers that are being perfected, which will make them more reliable. The hand controllers, meaning the two rotation controllers and the translation controller, in the spacecraft have worked well. But from some of the qualifications that have been run parallel to these, we found some discrepancies. These are being reworked at Minneapolis Honeywell and should be on the way down the Cape sometime today or tomorrow. In that they've been removed from the spacecraft, they must be checked out again. Jack Swigert, one of our astronaut support crew, went up to Minneapolis Honeywell to observe one of the tests for us last night. I expect a report from him sometime today on the status of that hand controller from an astronaut's viewpoint rather than from an engineering viewpoint. That obviously is a no-go until I get that report. Any others you can think of like that?
Yeah, we have a backup water dump system that has been incorporated in the Apollo spacecraft design. We have not yet seen the hardware. This is a kind of an 11th hour addition, and it's a very simple piece of equipment, but nevertheless it does have to be checked out and verified that it fits what it's supposed to attach onto and that it does work. That's one of the other, I would say, the major item that we need to see verified and demonstrated before we fly.
I'd like to infer from this, or I should say not infer, I'd rather make it fact, that we don't feel that these problems are insurmountable, but these are question marks at this point that must pass the test like anything else prior to our saying we buy this machine. It doesn't mean that we have any major design changes, it means that the equipment hasn't been integrated fully yet.
You all have stressed the safety aspects, and all of your film was devoted to this. Are you selling the program? Are you selling yourselves on this? Are you selling the public? Or are you just that totally concerned with safety as opposed to the rest of the mission?
Space flight's risky. And the best way to be safe is to sit here and look at a model and talk about it rather than go fly. There are many areas that we have concern about. We've been hurt in one, obviously, which was the environment. We've fixed that. We've got a hatch now that works properly. We've taken out those combustible materials that we suspect might cause problems. I think every area deserves a very careful scrutiny, and we're working on every area. This rendezvous that Don Eisley discussed for you is really a what-if. It's not something that should happen. The command module should not be required, and normally would never be, required to perform a rendezvous on the LEM. The LEM has the appropriate rendezvous equipment on board. The crew is trained on board the LEM to accomplish this task. But if they had a problem, we'd like to prove that the command module could in turn rescue them. This is the type of stress you might have in safety, from one, the environment, two, a way out rendezvous. Is that what the kind of question you wanted to answer?
Wally, how safe is safe? How safe do you three think this spacecraft is at this point? And as a corollary part of that question, how long has it taken you all in your actual tests from the time you start to work on the hatch ratchet until you're at the base of the pad?
Okay, first I'd say that when we go over the sill for launch day, we'll consider that all those risks that are appropriate for this type of mission are either understood by us or that they're low enough that we have a very, very high probability. We talk in terms of nines. I'd say we talk in terms of our lives being at stake, it'd probably be about five nines. I don't know how you can play one. Mission success, meaning everything we could possibly want to do on this mission and it would be done, it'd probably be on the order of about 0.85 or 0.80. And that, yes, we'd like to do 10.8 days and we'll do our best to do it. But it wouldn't be sensible, for example, if we had problems developing where the risk went up, to stay up there for 10.8 days. We'd have to come down early. And those are the sort of things where a thruster may start leaking and then another component might start failing. So you, for a total posture, you can't say everything is 100%, or anything, in fact. Now, the other question you asked, Jules, was how long would it take us to get out, I guess is the point. We found that we've taken about a minute and 5 seconds from the point when it was stated that there is an emergency egress to when we were standing outside in the white room. That's all three of us outside. Now, we've been very careful not to destroy the spacecraft or the equipment. I made note of that a number of times, only that if we had an emergency egress, we could care less about breaking a hand control of the instrument panel. There's something very wrong, and we'll get out. And I think we could probably get out probably about 45 seconds on that basis. It might tear the suits, but we could care less at that point. From the white room on down, depending on what path we take, it would probably take as much as 40 or 50 seconds by elevator and probably about 30 to 40 seconds by the slide wire. The slide wire is favorable to us because it takes us way away from the stack, some 1,200 feet, where the elevator keeps us in the stack area. And that decision would be a real-time decision before we egressed. If the problem were down in the stack, we would not take the elevator.
Over the sill until you're in the M113, for example.
You mean coming out of the spacecraft? I'd say 2 minutes and 30 seconds possibly at the most. That's from when you're lying there ready to launch to when you're in the M113, not prepared to do an egress mentally. You go down the launch pad to go fly. So you have to readjust yourself to the fact that you're egressing.
Not as safe as you think it can be or need be.
Other than putting ejection seats in here, I see no faster way. And that's not a very favorable mode either, and I've had that situation face me.
Could I make a comment relative to the... I know you all have been very interested in, I guess, after watching the film. I'd like to point out that this film has a lot of footage concerning these numerous egress training and tests that we've done. I guess that's because the footage is available and that kind of coverage. What is not shown there are the hundreds of hours that we have spent in simulations and meetings and whatnot preparing ourselves for the other aspect of the flight, and I'd just like to point out that we are not unduly occupied or concerned with this particular problem. We have rehearsed it numerous times, and we're confident that we're able to get out in a most expeditious manner, and that we feel quite secure about the whole business at this point.
The films that we might have taken to amplify that point of our meetings and management meetings and conferences and simulator hours in shirt sleeves are not apparently appealing, and we didn't bother showing those to you.
What sort of research experiments will you conduct, and how will they differ from flights such as Gemini or Mercury?
On this first flight, I might add, on the Mercury and Gemini first flights, we had very limited research experiments. On the total lunar mission program, we have had to cut back due to weight requirements, the total weight required for the mission. We've always been too heavy to a point where the experiments as such are conducted pre and post flight on the crew to some greater degree than we anticipated as a crew, I might add. This is from the physiological side. We thought we'd qualified man in space, but there's still some data collecting apparently required. We are carrying on board a camera, still camera, with various forms of film. Actually, we have two cameras on board still that are available to take pictures of the Earth as we have in the past for meteorological and geological observation. We have some various types of film to see if we can, from what we've learned in Gemini, that might help get us better pictures. But other than that, we have no classical experiments on board.
This would appear to be the only manned flight for the Saturn 1B. Do you have any comments on the booster?
I think it is appropriate that you made that remark, and I wish I'd brought it up earlier. The reason we're on the 1B is that this particular booster is less a dragster, if I may, than the Saturn V or the Saturn 1C. It's a very stable, almost Brooklyn Bridge structure. The design is almost over-designed in the sense of safety and strength. The system itself is built up of as Dr. von Braun says, if you make one booster, I'll cluster it and make a bigger one. Well, this is one of those. This has 8 engines on the bottom of it. One of those engines could fail, and we'd have no problem achieving orbit on the first stage. In fact, 2 can fail as time goes on, and we can still get into Earth orbit. So it's a very reliable workhorse concept with a new dragster up on top. Now, we're taking a new spacecraft up, the service module and the command module, that have had, I believe, the longest flight we've had on the command module so far unmanned is about 12 hours, somewhere in that order. We're asking for almost 12 days, 10.8 days. So we're putting the little machine on top that does all the fun stuff on the bottom of a very reliable booster, or on the top of a very reliable booster. Once having qualified the service module and command module, we can then start getting into the more exotic propulsion systems.
On the engines, I think in the previous 1B flights, this will be about the 14th flight on fundamentally this bird or this booster. I believe when we lost the second engine, we had an automatic abort, and that rule has slightly changed now. So you want to watch for that. We can lose 2 and still fly.
Pardon?
Yes, I
got
a Saturn 1, not a 1B.
I like the way you press the top.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Semi-logistics. What's your schedule between now and launch time? Are you going to be back and forth, or what kind of work are you going to be doing?
Well, for example, we have a final meeting with our flight control team. This is headed by Glenn Lunny, our flight director, Monday morning. We'll have a review of our final launch conditions, meaning the constraints to launch, probably early Monday afternoon. We'll leave for the Cape immediately. At the Cape, we'll have a briefing on the flight readiness review that was being conducted today, and a briefing on the flight readiness test that I described earlier that may occur as early as Wednesday. We have a simulator at the Cape. On Tuesday, we'll be on SimNet Sims, as we call it, which is working with the simulator coupled in with landlines to the Mission Control Center here, the same people we had the meeting with Monday morning. Except now we'll be talking to them electronically, through electronic means, simulating the flight itself. Wednesday, the flight readiness test, possibly. This test may last more than one day. And that typical pattern will go on. This is our last official weekend, if I may, in Houston. From then on, we'll be picking up. We've finished training. We're merely polishing up the rough edges. Repeating some of those areas that we may have a little more concern about than others, and that's about it.
Can you say anything about your sleep cycle? Do you all plan on sleeping or staying awake at the same time? And what do you plan on eating?
Let Don work that one.
You ask about the work-rest cycle? No. We have our flight set up now so that each day will be divided into 3 8-hour periods. One of those periods, which will coincide with the passes that we make over the United States, will be the period when all three of us are awake, and this will be the most active period each day, when we will execute the SPS burns and do most of the major test objectives and the like. There will be a second 8-hour period when Walt and Wally will be sleeping simultaneously.
And you put it the word together. Sorry about that, Lopes.
And I suggest you do the same.
Oh, boy, 10 days? So, that's my quiet hour, or hours, I guess. I'm awake and they're asleep, and we're going around. And we've tried to arrange the flight plan so that there isn't too much required during that period. I'm going to mind the store mostly, and with an occasional contact with MCC for state vector updates and messages of one sort or another, but mainly just having somebody on watch. The third period, of course, will be when I'm sleeping and Walt and Wally are awake. And with two people awake, we're not quite as constrained with respect to performing test objectives. There will be some activity going on. I hope not enough to keep me awake, but this, by the way, is somewhat of an experiment in itself, because on Gemini, with the two pilots in such close proximity to each other and a very low level of cabin noise, that they found that if they didn't sleep simultaneously, they disturbed each other. We think on this vehicle, because we do have a higher noise level in the cabin, and it's not objectionable, but it is a medium level hum most of the time, that this will tend to drown out the minor noises due to people shuffling around in their seats and so forth. Plus the fact that our sleep stations are now located beneath the crew couches, so that when you're down there sleeping or trying to sleep, you will at least be removed from the most active area of the spacecraft. We think this will work out pretty well for us. If it doesn't, if it turns out that we can't sleep while one fellow's awake, we'll have to go back to the old Gemini style, I guess. Regarding our food, it'll be the same sort of food that we had on board Gemini. And the rehydratables plus the bite size. And we've had a chance to sample all the food. And as far as I'm concerned, favorite foods?
Favorite foods?
No, I'm. Yeah, steak and French fries. I don't believe that's on the menu, though.
I have one thing to add to that, Lee. After living with these guys for the last 3 years, I know Wally and I don't have a worry in the world about keeping Don awake.
There's one thing about the food that is different. We will have heated water for reconstituting the food, and this is much more palatable than the cold water we had in the past. The water in the past was about, I'd say in Gemini, probably about 60 to 65 degrees Fahrenheit, which is quite cold. That's a good cold glass of water, if you think of it that way. Now we can heat the water up to a temperature of about 140 to 150 degrees, which makes the food much more palatable.
Commander, you've been going steady with your two crew members for a couple of years now and gotten to know them quite well. Some of the rest of us don't know them as well as we know you. How would you profile or characterize your crew members?
I guess the first thing to say is that Walt has held up admirably. When we first started out, I have been something of a punster, and Don, rather than fighting back, joined me. And he is also a very horrible punster. And Walt has a few, I don't think we've had an old boy out of him, but we've had a few fights back trying to keep us level-headed on our punning. But even now we're detecting that Walt's starting to pun, so I'm not sure what kind of air-to-ground communications you'll get out of this mission. But I think we've enjoyed working together. We've had a goal that's another hard one to achieve, particularly one that we have to follow on where we lost three of our compatriots, and we don't want any mistakes that might even be something like that to happen again. We haven't been the kid-around types that we might have been in the past. We're much more serious about it, because this is a much more complicated machine, and there are many, many more people involved in it. So the moments of levity haven't been as often we've often found. So we have to create our own by punting, possibly. I think you'll find that you'll see a good performance out of this total crew, and we've tried very hard to make this machine work just the way it should. We've basically lived with it at the plant, and we've been living with it at the Cape, and if someone even takes a small component off it, we become furious and say, why did you remove it? And we expect answers immediately. In fact, I am waiting for an answer as an example. Someone took our hatch cover off and took it to Downey today, and we haven't got the answer on why. And we don't like that. So that's the kind of way we're working.
Pardon me, I just went into shock.
I'm no.
Oh, boy.
I just got an old boy out of Don. That wasn't the hatch, that's the hatch cover, in case you get concerned.
I know Ruggiero Orlando wanted to ask a question in Italian. Would you like to answer it in Italian?
Wait, after the end.
Oh, you want to wait?
Can I do it after the end, 2 minutes with my cameraman and phone?
See. That's the limit of my Italian.
You're taking out some time for dehydrated chow?
Yeah.
Oh, there he goes again.
Very bad. Well, I guess we can take our break, Paul.
Yeah, why don't we break regroup? Up and maybe we could accommodate Orlando since we are finished here a little. I think he's got a camera and a problem. So thank you very much, and we'll begin in 15 minutes the world's largest interview hopscotch game. Goes on for 4 hours. It's a miracle.